Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Adding up the damage from the tornadoes in Alabama, Big Oil isn't as evil as its prophets suggest. And rap music and economics on the broadcast today, more fun than you might think. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It's Thursday, today the 28th of April. Good as always to have you with us. President Obama is going down to Alabama tomorrow to check out the tornado damage from last night for himself. Emergency federal aid is already on the way, he said today. Marketplace's Steve Chiatakis was in Alabama visiting family when the storms hit. He's been out reporting for us today. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Kai.
So give us some sense of what it was like on the ground today in Tuscaloosa, would you?
It was like some macabre parade of people looking at all this destruction. So imagine this. If you had this mix of people sifting through what was left of their homes, and then other people taking pictures of this stuff, and business owners trying to secure their stock or making sure their employees were safe. And all the while, this was really eerie. You had the smell of gas in the air, and then the sound of chainsaws and all these police sirens going by. I would say it was a sensory overload, really, just an awful scene.
Is anybody yet talking about business damage, lost costs, and insurance liabilities?
Not yet. It's hard to say. I've heard estimates climbing into the billions of dollars. And from what I saw today, just from a few hours ago, I can honestly say that wouldn't be out of the question. But think about this, Kai. The scene of destruction in Tuscaloosa, this place was pummeled, which killed at least a dozen people, maybe two dozen, is mimicked in other towns across the state and across the South. You have at least 160-plus people dead in Alabama and all these towns across the state that have a similar scene. And then multiply that with Mississippi in Georgia, Tennessee, Virginia. Yeah, billions of dollars, not out of the question, I don't think.
You got out and talked to some people. What'd they tell you?
Yeah, I did talk to a couple of folks who were hard hit. One woman, Deborah Burrows, owns the H&W Drugs East. It's a store her father started way back in 1964 in Tuscaloosa. The building was completely leveled. Only the front windows and the doors were still intact. As a matter of fact, the doors still had the glass in it, but the rest of the building completely leveled. And I asked her, are you going to rebuild?
Oh, I guess. Right now, we were able to recover our prescription file computer and set the backup tapes, so we'll be able to set up somewhere and at least get copies of people's prescriptions called into other stores so that they can get their medicine.
She seems really hopeful that her business will survive. At least that was the sense that I got from her. I talked to another guy, a guy named John Robles, and he's the manager of the Chipotle Grill down the street, probably about four or five storefronts down. Windows were blown out. The roof of his place was damaged severely. He's hoping to sell some burritos, though, as soon as he can.
Business is doing very, very well. It's been moving up and, you know, love to be open right now.
But this whole town is mostly closed for business, Kai, at least for the next few days.
Our morning report host, Steve Chiatakis, in his home state of Birmingham, Alabama today. Steve, thanks a lot.
You bet, Kai.
No storms on Wall Street this Thursday. Fairly placid all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'll set up this next story by mentioning that oil closed at almost $113 a barrel today. That way you won't be surprised when I mention that ExxonMobil reported a quarterly profit this morning that topped $10 billion. Royal Dutch Shell came in at almost $7 billion. Chevron reports tomorrow. And when numbers like that come out, you know what tends to follow. Politicians teeing up the evil oil industry rhetoric and knocking it right down the fairway. Both parties do it, except when they do, they usually leave one thing behind. The facts. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports on oil politics and political mythology.
Issue number one, big oil is not who you think. 40 years ago, the so-called Seven Sisters companies like Shell and Texaco lorded over 85% of world production. Now, the Seven Sisters are more like seven dwarves compared to, well, let's call them big oil.
Such as Saudi Aramco or Gazprom.
Former Shell president John Hofmeister. Today's behemoths are owned by governments in Saudi Arabia, Iran, Russia, Brazil, and today they control most reserves, while the multinationals hang at the kids' table.
They're essentially locked out of state-owned oil company reserves unless they are invited in.
U.S. firms also pay higher taxes than competitors, which takes us to issue two, tax breaks. President Obama wants to cancel some $4 billion worth. But Charles Ebinger at the Brookings Institution says brand-name oil companies don't get most of those preferences. Smaller drillers are far more dependent on subsidies. And if they went away...
I think you would see some degree of fall-off in domestic oil production and attendantly the loss of jobs in that particular part of the business.
Domestic production, issue three. Oil-friendly politicians want more drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, figuring that would push down American prices. Except that oil prices are set by global forces, and the biggest is galloping demand in emerging countries. Morningstar analyst Alan Good.
Even though, you know, we're producing oil here in the U.S., there's little we can do here in the U.S. to determine what the Chinese are going to pay or what the Indians are going to pay or so forth. So if there's buyers elsewhere in the world, it's going to drive up U.S. gasoline prices.
He says politicians have few levers to pull on energy prices. That may be a fact, but in this town, facts can be overlooked. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
No doubt you're used to that little routine a lot of us have, where we go shopping and we just charge it. Well, that phrase may soon have a whole new meaning. Macy's announced this week it's going to start installing charging stations for customers who drive electric vehicles. It's part of a government-funded project to promote the newest generation of electric cars, the Nissan Leaf and Chevy Volt being the two most talked-about examples. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk that retailers may end up leading the charge toward the EV transition.
Might is the operative word here. Macy's told us today this is a pilot project. They're installing a dozen electric car chargers at San Diego stores. The federal government is footing most of the bill. Its goal is 15,000 charging stations in six states. Macy's Jim Slezewski says the idea is...
to put charging stations in places where people are normally in the routine of their lives.
And there's nothing more routine for Americans than shopping, say electric car experts. Retailers are interested because they stand to gain customer goodwill and the distinct possibility that drivers of electric cars will shop more as they wait to juice up their vehicles. But it's not clear if it'll be free. The company making and installing the Macy's chargers told us today they'll initially charge a small fee, yet to be determined. But Ecotality President Don Carner says that business model may change in the future.
Couponing and free charging if you buy a certain amount within the store.
Best Buy and Cracker Barrel have also signed deals with Carner's company. The drugstore chain Walgreens will offer the same service starting in the Dallas area, but with a different company that's offering drivers unlimited charging for $79 a month. Still, the vast majority of charging stations won't be found at fast food outlets or shopping malls, at least initially. They'll be at home, in owners' driveways. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There was news of a peace agreement in the Middle East yesterday. It's between the two groups that have been arguing over who's really in charge of the Palestinian Authority. The current ruling party, Fatah, has come to terms with rival Hamas. But the reconciliation could complicate American foreign aid programs. The U.S. has sent billions of dollars to the Palestinian Authority over the years. But Hamas doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
If the U.S. did stop giving money to the Palestinians, this wouldn't be the first time. It cut aid in 2006 when Hamas won the Palestinian elections. More recently, though, Congress has been sending money to the Palestinian Authority, just not to Hamas. But some members of Congress and others are calling for an end to the handouts if Hamas and Fatah get together. Shibli Telhami is a professor at the University of Maryland. He says that's partly why Hamas and Fatah failed to reconcile sooner.
One reason they failed is the fear by the Palestinian Authority that they would lose support from the U.S. and particularly economic support from Congress.
But it's still much too early to tell whether the U.S. will cut off funding. Among other things, Fatah and Hamas haven't signed any agreement yet, so nobody knows what such an agreement or a unity government would actually look like. U.S. money has helped strengthen the economy in the West Bank, but at least financially speaking, that funding could be replaced. Henri Barquet is a professor at Lehigh University. He says politically, it's a different story.
Certainly, the Saudis and the other Gulf Arabs have a lot of money to invest, and they can easily supplant the United States financially. But it doesn't give the international cachet that the United States does.
And if the U.S. were to cut off funding, it wouldn't have the same leverage to negotiate with the Palestinians. The Palestinian Authority is pushing to be recognized as a state at the United Nations General Assembly meeting in September. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
We tend to talk about the Middle East as if it's a single place, the region, we say. But there are real differences depending on where you go in that region. The six countries that are members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, for instance, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait, to name just three, are generally richer. They're more interested in developing ties to the West, and as a result, have become destinations for American businesses, colleges in particular. More than a dozen American schools have exported their brands to the Gulf in the past decade, as Marketplace's Sean Cole reports.
When NYU opened up shop in Abu Dhabi, Michigan State University had just closed its undergraduate facility in Dubai. This was about a year after George Mason University pulled out of the nearby emirate of Ras Al Khaimah. And yet other branch campuses in the Gulf have persisted for 6 or 8 or 12 years. So the question is, why do some survive there and others don't? Let's start with one of the don'ts.
We could not have picked a worse time to start.
This is Dr. Kevin Dunseith.
I'm executive director of Michigan State University, Dubai.
Still, even though operations there have closed?
Operations haven't closed in Dubai.
MSU still runs a couple of grad programs there and a study abroad seminar, but the undergrad program is kaput. A lot of it was timing. The campus opened up right at the cusp of the financial crisis. But part of it was also planning.
We probably misjudged the market for the kind of undergraduate programs that we offer.
That is, not enough students in the region met MSU's criteria. And if you let those students in anyway, so goes industry wisdom, you risk cheapening the brand. If you don't, you might not make your enrollment numbers. And MSU didn't. Funny thing is, about 6 American campuses in Qatar, just down the way, are pretty much fishing in the same pool of would-be pupils. And they're doing great.
Well, I'm interested in what you mean by doing great, Sean.
Well, they still have undergraduate programs.
You mean they're still alive,
exactly.
They're still there, right?
Yep.
Okay.
The subtext being, you want to know why they're still there? For the same reason they picked the Gulf in the first place.
The Gulf countries offer essentially a free ride.
Philip Altbach heads up the International Center for Higher Education at Boston College. He says local governments in the Gulf often subsidize these operations, paying for everything.
The successful, and I use that in quotes, branches in Qatar say they're doing well. I have read also that almost none of them have the anticipated enrollments.
Just like MSU Dubai didn't. But it wasn't subsidized to the same degree. And Kevin Dunseith says MSU could never have offered students what NYU Abu Dhabi is offering.
If we'd been able to say to these students, we will give you a full scholarship. We will fly you in. We will even fly you in to have a look at our campus. We'll pay for your accommodation. We'll pay for your food. Don't you think those would be highly influential factors in those students making a decision about where they want to study?
I don't have to think. I have a telephone.
Joshua Shirley speaking.
Joshua Shirley is one of the pioneering freshmen at NYU's new campus.
Hi, Sean.
Hi. He was one of the top 2 students at his high school in Brisbane, Australia.
They flew me to Abu Dhabi, and I was interviewed. I met people on campus. I met lots of professors.
NYU only flew in a relative handful of Joshua Shirleys, and not everyone's getting the amenities mentioned earlier. But Joshua is, plus a flight home for the summer and $500 a semester just to spend. But he says he picked the school because it really feels like a global university, with kids from all over the world. And with just 150 of them, the classes are really small. So while money was a factor, he says,
it wasn't the decisive factor for me, given that my education in Australia at a high-level institution with a degree I was really interested in would have been fully subsidized.
And that, says NYU, is one of the reasons it's fully subsidizing kids like Joshua. They would have gotten a free ride back home. The school also told me it's looking into alternative streams of funding down the road. For the moment, though, the government of Abu Dhabi is footing the bill for everything. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
You can check out a map of American schools in the Middle East at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
The future's uncertain. Our outlooks are frail. That's why free markets are so prone to fail.
Keynes and Hayek throw down, but first, let's do the numbers. Stocks pushed higher at the end of the day. The Dow Industrials finished up 72 points, about 0.5%, closed at 12,763. The NASDAQ gained 2 points, about 0.1%, ended things at 2872. The S&P 500 tacked on 4 points, 0.3%, wrapped up at 1360. ExxonMobil wowed, as we said, with a $10.6 billion profit last quarter, but the oil giant still drained about 0.5% from its share price today. ConocoPhillips lost nearly 3%. BP leaked 0.5%. Insurers were strong this earnings season, all beating expectations. Allstate insured, a 5.7% gain. Aflac waddled up 5% today. Lincoln National and Aetna each rose about 4%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.31%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, including In the Plex by Stephen Levy or The New Frugality by Chris Farrell, go to audiblepodcast.com/marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. President Obama is scheduled to meet with the governor of Alabama to survey the damage caused by tornadoes in the region. A look at how much money we made and how much left our wallets in March. The Commerce Department releases its monthly report on personal income and spending. Oh, and there's this wedding tomorrow. Prince William and Kate Middleton get hitched. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Economists like to say that incentives matter. You make something lucrative or painful enough and people are going to change their behavior. That truism is playing out for a lot of public employees as their retirement benefits are put at risk in state budget negotiations. From WUWM in Milwaukee, Aaron Toner explains.
For the past two decades, 57-year-old Janet Badura worked with thousands of families as an employee of Milwaukee County. She helped parents of severely disabled children find support services like respite care and summer camp.
Well, I always thought that public service was a noble profession, and I still do. I think there's something very satisfying with working for the public good. A person with a disability myself, I have received services in the past growing up, and so I always felt that I needed to give back.
But earlier this month, Badura signed her retirement papers, even though she planned to continue working for at least another year. She's getting out now because state lawmakers here have approved a bill stripping public employee unions of most of their bargaining rights. Badura worried that without collective bargaining, her agreed-upon retirement benefits could change if existing contracts were rewritten. Several of Badura's colleagues have reluctantly made the same decision.
I think it was really scary because our pensions aren't that great. You know, no one wanted to retire.
Badura and her coworkers are among more than 200 Milwaukee County employees who retired between January and March, a 65% increase over the same period a year ago. Jerry Schrader is head of the county's retirement system.
Janitors to entry-level clerical positions to management level. It transcends worker classification.
Along with those local government workers, nearly 5,000 state of Wisconsin employees also applied for retirement in the first quarter. It's a choice civil servants around the country are making as more states consider scaling back public employee benefits. In Oregon and New Jersey, public employee retirements were up about 50%. Tim Sheehy is president of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. He says the early retirements, along with changes to public employee health and retirement benefits, will help Wisconsin's bottom line.
There's no question that the state has a tremendous fiscal imbalance. It's got a $3.6 billion deficit. It's a deficit we've carried since I can remember, and so this is an opportunity to kind of right the ship.
Many in the ranks of the newly retired are teachers. 60-year-old Claudia Caves teaches English at Kettle Moraine High School in southeast Wisconsin. She's leaving the classroom for good this summer, 3 years earlier than planned.
I have a master's degree plus 36 credits, and I'm a National Board Certified Teacher, and I'm taking all that experience right out the door with me.
The rush among some public employees to enter their golden years early could be a mixed blessing. Governments save a lot of money when their more senior and highest-paid employees leave, but those workers take with them a wealth of knowledge and experience. Brooks Holtum is a professor of management at Georgetown University.
if you believe that people continually improve their skills over time, losing your most experienced workers could be very difficult for an organization.
But it appears some local governments are having it both ways, cutting costs and keeping experience. In Wisconsin, some new retirees who've started collecting their pensions have been hired back into their old government jobs as contract workers without benefits. In Milwaukee, I'm Erin Toner for Marketplace.
When you talk the broad sweep of bad blood rivalries, there's David and Goliath, Lakers versus the Celtics, Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader too. None of those, though, are as relevant to us right now as the feud between two dead economists, John Maynard Keynes and Friedrich Hayek. Their ideas helped shape the debates that we're having right now about financial regulation and stimulus spending and reducing the deficit. Thing is, they can be a bit dry. So enter television producer John Popola, George Mason University economist Russ Roberts, and rap music.
Here we are, peace out, great recession. Thanks to me, as you see, we're not in a depression. Recovery, destiny, if you follow my lesson. Lord Keynes, here I come, line up for the procession.
We brought out the shovels and we're still in a ditch and still digging. Don't you think it's time for a switch from that hair of the dog? Friend, the party is over. The long run is here. It's time to get sober.
Are you kidding?
Their music video, it's called Fight of the Century, is out today. Russ, John, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
So this is, Russ, a follow-up to your video of last year, Fear the Boom and Bust, Keynes and Hayek, wrapping it out. It was immensely successful, but why do we need another one?
Economy's still struggling.
Yeah.
People are still concerned about what we're going to do next. And John and I thought we got to bring the debate back about which way we should go. Which way should we choose? More from the top or from the ground? More out of Washington or more out of the rest of the country and individual choices?
It is also sadly sort of dull policy. I mean, this whole debate is thrilling to economists, but not necessarily to the general public, which I guess is the vessel for this whole thing.
Well, I think there's a lot at stake, and I think people realize it. Whether the economy is going to recover or not, how big government's going to be relative to the private sector. These are important issues, and I think people are pretty engaged.
John, I get where Russ is coming from. He's the economics professor, and this is kind of his gig. You're a TV guy. What's with the econ from you?
You know, it's a funny thing. I started getting into these ideas because I have a long commute into the city and had to fill it with something other than Angry Birds. So, and then, you know, when the crisis sort of unraveled in 2008 and 2009 and 2010, it sparked my interest like nothing before. And I was listening to Russ's econ talk.
His podcast, yeah.
Yeah. So basically, I've taught myself economics, or Russ taught me economics through podcasts.
So we're going to play a little bit of it, Russ. And then I want to talk about the actual economics of this debate. And this little thing we're going to play here is Hayek and Keynes arguing about jobs.
Jobs are a means, not the ends in themselves. People work to live better, to put food on the shelves. Real growth means production of what people demand. That's entrepreneurship, not your central plan.
My solution is simple and easy to handle. It's spending that matters. Why's that such a scandal? Money sloshes through the pipes and the sluices, revitalizing the economy's juices. It's just
like so you get spending from Keynes there at the very end, Russ, and we saw it in the Fed chairman's press conference yesterday, talking about what we can do to get jobs into this economy. Lay out the economic argument for us, the differences between Keynes and Hayek. Give us the primer.
Well, the Keynesian view is that spending of any kind is helpful. Keynes famously wrote that you could dig holes and fill them back in, and that would stimulate the economy. The Hayekian view is you can create jobs by paying people to do stuff, but the key is you've got to do something that people value. Otherwise, you're just pretending. You're not creating true value.
There's actually a verse that goes, let's not repeat what created our trouble.
I want real growth, not a series of bubbles. Stop bailing out losers. Let prices work. If we don't try to steer them, they won't go berserk. Come on, are you kidding? Don't Wall Street gyrations challenge a worldview of self-regulation? Even you must admit that the lesson we've learned is more oversight's needed or else we'll get burned. Oversight?
John, this looks like, and is, I mean, a professional high-quality video. How do you finance something like this? Did you guys go out and do this on your credit cards?
No, we didn't. I'm not a big fan of debt.
Touché.
As a Hayekian, it's a It creates a fragile situation for us. We have a website, econstories.tv, mm-hmm. which we created with the first video, which was done on a shoestring. And you can donate to us on that site, and that's how this video got funded.
Have you heard from your professional colleagues in academia about your dabbling in rap and video?
They get a kick out of it. You know, economics tends to be taught as a pretty dry activity, and John and I are so passionate about bringing a livelier approach, which is what this is all about.
Russ Roberts and John Popola, their video is called Fight of the Century, Keynes and Hayek Round 2. You can see it on our website. Their website is called econstories.tv. You ought to check it out. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a small business bright spot in the tornado story. Lisa Rice of Trenton, Georgia, opened her tanning salon, SNL Tans, right there on Main Street in Trenton, not too long ago. She and her daughters were at work in the shop last night when the storms hit, so they did the best and safest thing they could think of. They climbed into a couple of tanning beds. Salon's ruined, everybody's fine, but the best part? The daughters' names, Stormy and Sky. Once again, not making this up. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you again right back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.